The Australian Years, 1891 to 1900, Volume 4, Chapter 10, 1893, Evangelism, the Struggle for a Foothold. Of Wellington, and of New Zealand in general, Ellen White cried out almost in despair, "God has a people in this place, and how can we reach them?" Letter 9a, 1893. Writing to the churches in America, she said, "The city abounds in churches, and I have never seen a place where prejudice was stronger or opposition so perseveringly and determinately carried on. I was reminded of the prejudice of the priests and Pharisees in the days of Christ." At Wellington, a branch of the International Tract and Missionary Society had been established, but there was no house of worship. We were dependent upon halls, and the people did not attend meetings in these halls. We tried to hold meetings in Elder Israel's house. We did everything possible to get the people out. We circulated notices, leaflets, tracts. Workers went from house to house, sowing the seed upon ground that had hitherto proved unfruitful. To the utmost of our ability, we labored to create an interest in this place, and at no small outlay of means, and yet the prejudice seemed like a granite wall. A few times we had a moderately large congregation, but the people seemed afraid of us. We worked on, however, trying to do our part as faithful messengers, for we had a message to bear of the utmost importance. Though our efforts showed no manifest results, I remembered that of Christ it was said, "He shall not fail nor be discouraged." We need the mind of Christ to enable us to work in His lines, DF 28a, Experiences in Australia, pages 424, 425. She explained how the ministers had told their congregations that there was danger in going to hear the Adventists. "These people," they said, "have no special interest in Wellington. Few will believe in their doctrines. They have no one to represent them here. If they make you believe in their doctrines, where will you go to worship? They have no place of worship. They are only adventurers." Ibid. 425, 426. They characterized the teachings of Seventh-day Adventists as satanic doctrines that would mislead the people. A few days at Long Point on July 26, Ellen White felt that she needed a break in her work. "Our stay here is too monotonous," she exclaimed. "One cannot keep upon one strain continuously without breaking down. It has been one steady strain early and late, but there must come a halt." Manuscript 81, 1893. At 6:30 in the morning, Ellen White was writing, and the rain was coming down in torrents. The wind, which had been blowing all night, was shaking the house, and even shook the bed. As the clouds broke away in mid-morning, she thought of the invitation she had just received from Martha Brown, who, when Ellen White had first come to Wellington, had helped with the cooking. Martha Brown was inviting her to bring Emily Campbell, who was badly worn, and come to Long Point for a few days' rest and change. "We cannot well leave this week, but we will be off next week, if the Lord wills," Mrs. White noted, and repeated, "we need some change." Ibid. It was not the next week but the next day that they were off for the little change. M.C. Israel accompanied them on the train to Parramatta and Long Point, an hour and a half from Wellington. Describing the trip, she wrote, "We passed through 8 tunnels. The scenery was odd and romantic. Much of the road on this line is through a gorge, very deep in many places. Then we would see nice little farms in the valleys, and then again steep mountains and waterfalls." Manuscript 59, 1893. At the station, Martha Brown, a young woman in her late 20s, was awaiting them with a horse and gig to take them the mile to the Brown home. Situated on a rise of ground with a good view of the bay, and surrounded by flowers, shrubs, and trees and encircled by hills and high mountains, the large house was most inviting. Ellen White and those with her were given a hearty welcome and felt quite at home. Martha's mother, a congenial woman, had been a widow for 8 years and was the mother of 13 living children. She had had a rather hard life, and of course a busy one. In addition to the children at home, 3 unmarried children lived on a farm rented to them by their mother at quite a distance from Long Point. Martha was the first member of the Brown family to become a Seventh-day Adventist, followed by her mother. At this point, they stood alone in that faith. Ellen White found herself in the midst of a needy mission field. She determined to let her light shine. "I labored with the family," she wrote, "every morning and night." Letter 138, 1893. Monday morning, August 7, at 1 a.m., she recorded in her diary, "I was awakened repeating these words, 'While it is called today. Today if you will hear His voice, harden not your hearts, as in the provocation.'" Hebrews 3 verses 13 to 15. "In the night season I had been in different companies bearing a message to them. I was in the family of Sister Brown, and was instructed by the angel of God to call them to a decision by speaking to each one of the children by name. Isabella was 22 years old and had a strong influence with the younger members of the family. She was very worldly, with a love for parties and dancing. At family worship that Monday morning, Ellen White addressed her. Will you give your heart to Jesus? Will you cut the cords binding you to the world, its pleasures and attractions, and leave the service of Satan and be a follower of Christ? She said, I will. Next was Alex, the only boy at home, and who was obliged to bear heavy responsibilities for a boy of 16. He was of quick understanding. I addressed myself to Alex. I said, will you decide this morning to confess Jesus Christ? Will you this very morning choose to be a child of God and engage to serve the Lord Jesus to the best of your ability? He responded, I will. Victoria was quite grown up for a girl of 14 years. Turning to her, Ellen White addressed her by name, Jesus says to you this morning, Victoria, follow me. Will you obey his voice? Will you enter the school of Christ to learn of him? She responded decidedly, I will. Then it was Charlotte to whom Ellen White spoke. I am sure you wish to be a child of God. You wish to learn of Jesus. You love the Lord Jesus. Will you confess that you love him? She responded. And now my heart was broken before the Lord, melted with his love, wrote Ellen White, and we had a Thanksgiving morning service. It was a precious season to us all. Manuscript 59, 1893. But that was not the full extent of the fruitful missionary endeavors. On Thursday night, August 3rd, a vivid scene had been presented to her, and at 4 o'clock in the morning she arose and began to write, the angel of God said, follow me. I seemed to be in a room in a rude building, and there were several young men playing cards. They seemed to be very intent upon the amusement in which they were engaged and were so engrossed that they did not seem to notice that anyone had entered the room. There were young girls present observing the players, and words were spoken not of the most refined order. There was a spirit and influence that were sensibly felt in that room that was not of a character calculated to purify and uplift the mind and ennoble the character. I inquired, who are these and what does this scene represent? The word was spoken, wait. I had another representation. There was the imbibing of the liquid poison, and the words and actions under its influence were anything but favorable for serious thoughts, clear perception in business lines, pure morals, and the uplifting of the participants. I asked again, who are these? The answer came, a portion of the family where you are visiting. The great adversary of souls, the great enemy of God and man, the head of principalities and powers, and the ruler of darkness of this world, is presiding here tonight. Satan and his angels are leading on with his temptations these poor souls to their own ruin. Letter 1, 1893. The communication addressed to the mother and the children and sent to them after Ellen White returned home was blessed by God in leading these young men to the Lord. Among the eventual grandchildren were two who served the church as ministers and editors, and others as teachers and in other capacities. The visit to the home was to be for a week, but when Thursday came it rained so hard that they could not leave. Friday morning they went in the rain to the railway station and waited an hour for the train, only to learn that a landslide had occurred and there would be no train. Of the experience Ellen White wrote, we decided our work was not done and felt reconciled to the delay. We spent Sabbath with the family, and I labored hard to present before them the important crisis that is just before us, when there will be two distinct parties, the one elevating the standard of truth, the other trampling underfoot the law of God and lifting up and exalting the spurious Sabbath. It is God's great plan that the Sunday question shall be agitated and the Sabbath of the fourth commandment be exalted as the Lord's memorial sign of the creation of the world, and that a knowledge of truth upon the Sabbath question shall be brought before many minds as a witness, Manuscript 59, 1893. The service in the Brown home that Sabbath morning commenced at 11 a.m. and did not close until 2 p.m. Monday, August 7th, promised to be a good day, and Ellen White and Emily decided that they must return to Wellington. They felt they could reach the station between showers and started out. We did, wrote Ellen White, almost. Bedding and trunks got wet, but the train was on time. The second-class car was full, and men were lighting their pipes. The three ladies, Martha Brown was with them, felt they must find some other provision. They were allowed to ride in the freight car, a more compact car than those in America. With her spring seat on a freight box and the bedding roll at her feet, Ellen White was quite comfortable. There was a box of dogs nearby, some rather smelly fish, and plenty of boxes of freight. At subsequent stops, they were joined by other passengers, until there were seven women sitting on boxes of freight, and about as many men were standing. We were thankful to get home anyway, she wrote, after making this third trial. Ibid. At Hastings and Napier doors seemed closed in Wellington. Ellen White was still waiting for her much-needed dental plates, but was feeling quite well and had found she could talk so as to be understood, even without teeth. She, M.C. Israel, and Mr. Mountain studied plans for the immediate future. They thought it would be well to join G.T. Wilson, now the conference president, and his wife, who were working in Napier and Hastings. There, several people were just in the balance of decision, for or against the message of the church. Tuesday morning, August 15th, they were off early for Hastings, a 10-hour trip by train. Ellen White, Emily Campbell, and Nina Piper, whom they took with them to assist in the home duties. They were to be in Hastings for several weeks, and they wanted to avoid being a burden wherever they might stay. On the train were many Maoris, natives of New Zealand, a people among whom Mrs. Caro was beginning to do missionary work with some favorable response. At one station, Ellen White and her traveling companions had a unique experience. "We saw for the first time the ceremony of salutation, the rubbing of noses." She commented, "It was a novel sight." Manuscript 84, 1893. At Hastings they were taken to the Wilson home, where they were to stay. It was a large home, and the visitors were easily accommodated. Wednesday evening, 25 people gathered in the home. Ellen White spoke with great freedom. Three in the audience were not members of the church. One of them was a woman who, by reading Daniel and the Revelation and the great controversy sent to her by her son in Wellington, was deeply interested. Following Ellen White's remarks, there was a social meeting in which the people bore their testimony to God's providences. "These social meetings," she commented, "do more than preaching to ripen off the work." It was here that Ellen White wrote in her diary, "Wednesday, August 16, 1893, I see so much to be thankful for in my case. The Lord is my restorer. I am able to kneel down now. I feared I might not ever be able to bow upon my knees in prayer. For more than 1 year I was unable to bend the knees to kneel down, but I am gaining all the time and health, for which I praise the Lord who is so good to me. His mercies are seen every day." Ibid. W.C. White, after 3 months in Australia, was now back in New Zealand, and joined others in a special interest in the Maoris, who rather thickly populated this area. One 16-year-old Maori lad, who attended a nearby school and who had begun to keep the Sabbath, came to talk with the workers in Napier about attending the Australasian Bible School in Melbourne. Some others would soon be going to Battle Creek College. Mrs. Caro gave freely to aid them, and Ellen White promised support for one Maori student at the Melbourne school. For nearly 2 months she divided her time between Hastings, Napier, and Ormondville. Here and there baptisms were reported, and things were beginning to look up. It was thought, as the brethren counseled together, that the time had come when Mrs. White could return to Australia, by way of Auckland. But just then a telegram came informing them that the missionary brigantine Pitcairn, a 100-foot sailing vessel built in 1890 for use as a missionary ship in the South Pacific, paid for by Sabbath school offerings, would be in Auckland in a few days. There was trouble on board, and it seemed essential that W.C. White should spend a little time with the crew. Another telegram informed them that O.L. Olson, president of the General Conference, would be arriving from Africa in time to attend the camp meeting that was scheduled to open in Wellington November 23, DF-28A, Experiences in Australia, pages 499-500. Plans for an early return to Australia were dropped, and their minds turned to preparing for the meeting. A new approach in Gisborne. There would be several weeks before camp meeting would open, and it was now planned that Ellen White and Emily Campbell would accompany G.T. Wilson and his wife to Gisborne for an evangelistic thrust. For years a little company had been worshipping in Gisborne, but the work very much needed a boost. Prejudice against Seventh-day Adventists was strong there. The question was how to approach the people. So far, except in a few places, almost every conventional means of reaching the people in New Zealand in a favorable way had failed. As the little worker group counseled together, they decided to try a new approach to arrest the attention of the public. Ellen White described what took place in letters to her son W.C. White and to her niece Addie Walling. "We thought we would strike out on a new line. We would have Sunday afternoon services in an open-air meeting. We did not know how it would come out. Brother Wilson and Brother Alfred Wade secured the paddock just back of the post office. There was one large willow tree. Under this a platform was made and the organ and stand placed on the platform. Lumber for seats was right in the yard, costing nothing for their use," Letter 140, 1893. "There were seats without backs in abundance, and a dozen taken from the church with backs. The weather was favorable, and we had an excellent congregation. The mayor and some of the first people in Gisborne were in attendance. I spoke upon temperance, and this is a living question here at this time. Hundreds were out to hear, and there was perfect order. Mothers and any number of children were present. You would have supposed that the children had had an opiate, for there was not a whimper from them. My voice reached all over the enclosure. Paddock is the name they give it here. Some of the hearers were very enthusiastic over the matter. The mayor, the policeman, and several others said it was by far the best gospel temperance discourse that they had ever heard. We pronounced it a success and decided that we would have a similar meeting the next Sunday afternoon," Letter 68, 1893. They did hold just such a meeting the next Sunday afternoon. It, too, was a decided success. Ellen White commented, "One thing we have learned, and that is that we can gather the people in the open air, and there are no sleepy ones. Our meetings were conducted just as orderly as if in a meeting house." Ibid. A church member declared, "It is altogether the best advertisement of our people they have ever had in Gisborne." Letter 140, 1893. Prejudice was broken down, and from that time on, the meetings in the church and the Theatre Royal were well attended. At last they had witnessed a breakthrough. It was while in Gisborne that Ellen White received a letter from Edson telling of his reconversion after reading her agonizing admonition to beware of the undertow. Immediately she acknowledged the good news, October 21st, Edson, the Lord Jesus is of tender, pitying loving kindness. This day we received your letter and were very glad that you had indeed made the surrender to God. I am glad more than I can express that you have, in the simplicity of faith, accepted Jesus, and I am not surprised that you found something to do at once. Never fail or be discouraged. It is that which you ought to have done long ago, and your mother will give you encouragement and her prayers, and so will your brother. Years that have passed into eternity are beyond your power to recall, but through the grace of Christ you may labor in the vineyard for the Master. Letter 120, 1893. Countdown to camp meeting. As the fall camp meeting in Napier had come to a close in early April, the believers had been promised that the next such meeting would be conducted at Auckland in the spring. But now as the time neared, it seemed very important to hold it in Wellington instead, to make, if possible, a breakthrough in that most difficult place. W.C. White was dispatched to Auckland to explain matters to the believers there and get their wholehearted support for the Wellington meeting. Just before leaving Gisborne, Ellen White addressed a letter to dear brethren and sisters in New Zealand, urging a strong attendance. It opened, "I have an appeal to make to our churches to attend the coming camp meeting in Wellington. You cannot afford to lose this opportunity. We know that this meeting will be an important era in the history of the work in New Zealand. There should be particular efforts made to get a representation of those who believe the truth to this meeting, for the very reason we are so few in numbers, and the additional help of everyone is called for. The enemies of truth are many in number. On such an occasion as this, we want to present as good a front as possible. Let not your business detain you. You individually need the benefits of this meeting, and then God calls you to number one in the ranks of truth." Letter 81, 1893. In the meantime, she journeyed to Napier. W.C. White, who would travel on the Pitcairn, left Gisborne for Wellington. When a full week later no word had reached Wellington of the arrival of the Pitcairn, Ellen White, at the Caro home, was concerned. Then the long-awaited telegram came. Pitcairn arrived in Wellington Sabbath afternoon, November 11th. Encountered calm and tempests. Allweld Manuscript 87, 1893. Ellen White was fitted with new teeth, and then traveled to Ormondville for the weekend and the dedication of the newly erected house of worship. On Monday, November 20th, they were on their way to Wellington, arriving there at 10 o'clock at night. W.C. White was on hand to meet the train. They hastened to hired rooms. The Wellington camp meeting. New tents, both large and small, had been shipped from Australia and were now being pitched on high and dry ground in a beautiful fenced paddock within walking distance of the city of Wellington. It was with somewhat bated breaths that church members and others watched the process. Wellington was well known for its fierce winds. Not long before this, a circus tent had been torn to shreds by the high wind. Church leaders knew well the risks. "Our earnest prayer," wrote Ellen White, "is that this encampment may have the favor of God. The winds and fountains of waters are in His hands, under His control." Manuscript 88, 1893. God did hold His sheltering hand over the encampment. An early report to the Bible Echo indicated this: "Every provision is made, and every care taken, to carry out the arrangements with facility and decorum. The tents are arranged in streets. The large tent has seating accommodation for about 600." January 1, 1894. Olson arrived during the opening days of the meeting, and he became the main, and much appreciated, speaker. Pitcairn was in port, and her officers and crew were a help to the meeting. Dr. M. G. Kellogg, the medical missionary of the ship, was drawn into service and spoke from day to day on health topics in Christian temperance, which were reported to be one of the most telling and interesting features of the meetings. Ibid. From the very beginning, Ellen White was often on the platform and almost every day addressed the congregation. Sabbath afternoon she spoke, and again on the afternoon of Sunday, her 66th birthday. She felt great freedom as she took pleasure in showing our colors on which were inscribed the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. Reporting the response, she wrote, "I told them that we were Seventh-day Adventists, and the reason of the name which distinguished us from other denominations. All listened with deepest interest." Letter 75, 1893. Sunday evening the tent was full when G.T. Wilson was the speaker. Ellen White's disclosure of the identity of the people holding the meetings did not deter a good attendance. In a letter to Edson, she told of their concern for the success of the meeting. "We had much fear lest we would have a very slim attendance, but we were happily disappointed. From the first to the last, there was a good appearance of congregation of the best class of our own people who fed on the bread of life during the meeting. Evenings there were good-sized congregations of outsiders. We have had good, large, respectful audiences, and a very large number of people now understand what we do believe. The discourses have been close, plain, and thorough upon present truth, appropriate and applicable to our time. The people listened as if spellbound. The citizens were impressed with this meeting as nothing else could have transpired to impress them. When the winds blew strong, there would be many looking with wonder to see every tent standing unharmed." Letter 121, 1893. What a victory had at last been gained! Walls of prejudice were crumbling. As the camp meeting opened, Ellen White observed that Mrs. Brown, of Long Point, only 20 miles distant, was not there. She hastened off a note to her, "Dear Sister Brown and household, we sincerely hope that you will not lose this opportunity of attending the meeting brought so near your own door. Come, mother and children and sister lounge. We want to enjoy this holy convocation with you, and bring all the children you can spare from the home place, for this meeting is that which you all need to strengthen and confirm your faith, and you want to hear the message which God has for you. Be sure and bring the younger members of the family. You will never regret the expense or the trouble. It is seldom you will be favored, and perhaps never with such an opportunity. You can and must come, Sister Brown. You need all the help and all the strength you can possibly gain to help you in your life work." Letter 74, 1893. And she did come, with part of the family attending the earlier days of the camp meeting and the others coming later. How Ellen White rejoiced! She reported to Edson, "The mother and three youngest members of the family came: Alex, 16 years old, and the two girls, one 14 and the youngest 9. These children remained with the mother, were baptized, and returned to their home and sent the older members, four grown daughters from 17 years of age to 30. These were all united with the Wellington Church after their baptism. They have a church now at Long Point, Parramatta, numbering 9 of their own household." Letter 121, 1893. During the meeting, Ellen White wrote a letter, "The camp meeting is a success. It is a marvel of wonders to Wellington. Meetings have been held for 1 week. This camp meeting will give character to our work and do more to counteract the falsehoods that ministers have framed for others to repeat. The Lord is in the encampment. The Spirit of God is moving upon the hearts of believers and unbelievers. Visitors are pouring in to wonder over and admire the well-fitted up tents which are to be the homes of those camping on the ground." Letter 75, 1893. Others agreed with Ellen White in the success of the meeting and of its far-reaching influence. This was reported in the January 8, 1894, Bible Echo. Indeed, the whole meeting was a spiritual feast. The people returned to their homes rejoicing in the liberty they enjoy in Christ Jesus, and praising God for His goodness and mercy. 24 persons were baptized as a result of the services. Dr. Kellogg and G.E.T. Wilson remained in Wellington for a time to follow up the camp meeting interest. In the meantime, the tents were quickly dismantled and shipped to Australia for use in their first camp meeting, scheduled to open in a suburb of Melbourne on January 5. Return to Australia. Within a week of the close of the camp meeting, Ellen White had closed up her work and was one of quite a large group, which included W.C. White and O.L. Olson, on their way back to Australia. Ellen White's visit to New Zealand was confined to the North Island. She never labored in Christchurch or other cities on the South Island. They boarded the Wairarapa at Wellington on Wednesday, December 13, for the 7-day ocean journey. Friday morning they were at Auckland for a stay of a day and a half, which gave the traveling party opportunity to attend services in the Adventist Church there on Friday evening and Sabbath morning. The trip was a rough one, with waves at times swamping the deck. None of the travelers fared well. Ellen White was given the privilege of sleeping in the ladies' lounge each night when it was vacated at 10. The stewardess, Mrs. McDonald, was very kind to Mrs. White, and the latter gave her Steps to Christ and some pamphlets and papers. As Ellen White had opportunity, she talked with her about her soul's salvation and pointed out the perils of any whose life was on the sea. Mrs. McDonald's response was, "If I could, I would be a Christian, but I cannot. It would be an impossibility to serve God on such a vessel as this." Manuscript 88, 1893. Then she opened up and told of the wickedness of the officers and the crew, and of how she wanted to seek other employment to support herself and four children, but had not done so because the job paid better than others and she needed all she could earn. There was an earnest conversation about the Christian life and prayer, but she held out that it is no use to pray here, or try to be religious. Later, one of the crew told Emily Campbell, "I have been much impressed that this boat will go down with all hands on board ere long. I have felt so strongly exercised that I shall not, if I can possibly disconnect from it, continue to remain on the boat." Ibid. A few weeks later the ship was lost in a storm, and the crew member who had predicted its fate was one of only two rescued. The stewardess nurse was listed among those who did not survive. Arriving in Sydney Wednesday morning at about 9 o'clock, the traveling workers were taken to the International Tract and Mission House. All were hungry for both food and mail. Mail interested Ellen White the most. There was a letter from Edson, and she wrote in her diary for December 20th, "It is like the prodigal son returned to his father's house. Edson and wife are obtaining a rich experience." Manuscript 89, 1893.